Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
As we said earlier, today the head of FEMA said that for the first time, the government will trigger and use the Defense Production Act, contracting private companies to produce thousands of COVID-19 test kits. This Korean War-era act is something that governors have been pleading for, but President Trump worried in a press briefing that it would make the U.S. like Venezuela, which nationalized industries, took them over. This act does not do that. It allows the government to ask companies to make things and then guarantees them pay. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, we want to talk to you about national security, but just your thoughts on actually triggering this act. Do you think it's going to help?
Yes, I do. I mean, right now we have 50 customers, the 50 individual states that are all competing against each other and against other public and private customers for critical public health supplies. And this act, which was passed in 1950 during the Korean War, allows the federal government to intervene and control the production and or the distribution of those critical goods critical to U.S. national security. In the 50s, we used it for steel and mining, and now we're going to use it for masks and test kits and some other things. But it gives the government broad authority and all sorts of different tools, from wage and price controls to loans and incentives, to try to goose the production of critical supplies that are in shortage.
Okay, to national security. Is this pandemic now affecting ours?
I think it has, and I think in ways that are both positive and negative. So what are the, you know, let's get some good news on the table here. I think the risk during a pandemic, a global pandemic, the risk of war, the risk of armed conflict in general declines. At least the use of ground troops, you know, countries are focused on their domestic situation, and they may have to use their militaries as we have in the U.S. to carry out civilian tasks. And then in addition, you know, one of the traditional motivations for conflict is you go grab someone else's territory because you think it's valuable. Well, that's complicated if that territory is filled with, cases of coronavirus. Mm. So and war fighting in a practical sense is very difficult. So for the duration of this phase, I think armed conflict in the world is probably going to decline. People are going to stay indoors. They're not going to fight.
Yeah. Well, what about the risk from countries that could pose a threat to the U.S. before this outbreak? North Korea, Iran. We know there's a terrible outbreak in Iran. We don't know, you know, if we can trust the numbers from the government there, but the numbers are pretty high. Do we have a clue about North Korea?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've been worried about this for a while. North Korea, as you allude to, officially denies that it has any cases, but it acts in a way that suggests that the virus is there. And it's inconceivable that it's not there. It's smack dab right next to China. But they've announced quarantines. They've announced the construction of a large hospital. You know, that tells me that they have cases. And they have a notoriously shaky healthcare system, arguably the most vulnerable, if only because of U.S. and international sanctions. But I assume China must be helping them out of self-interest, if not humanitarian motivation. But we just don't know the state of it. And as you point out, in Iran, it's ravaging Iran. Iran is, you know, up there with Italy. It's one of the hardest hurt. U.S. sanctions have undermined the humanitarian effort there because it's hard to get goods in there. Talk about shortages. And interestingly, the most at-risk group, it seems to me, in Iran, you know.
Oops. Wait, don't leave us hanging. The most at-risk group in Iran is? We'll have to see if we can get Jim back to fill in that blank. But, of course, Iran, I'll start filling in some of these statistics. Iran has more than 24,000 confirmed coronavirus cases, more than 1,900 deaths. We spoke recently to a reporter. We can link you up to that story at hereandnow.org. He'd been detained there, and he said that the government is just not transparent. So do we have Jim Walsh back?
Yes.
Yeah, so no problem. But so you were saying the most at-risk population in Iran is?
Is the older clerics. I mean, these folks who are in group settings and who are up in age. It's true of everywhere, but it's true of them. And they're the group that's in charge. Now, I don't think that's, you know, I don't know what internal implications that has. But it's definitely going to shake things up. I think in the short term, both North Korea and Iran are going to hunker down. They're not going to be looking to pick fights in the middle of a crisis. But they're going to come out of this and they may be angry and they may be desperate. And, you know, that could lead to maybe a negotiation, but that could lead to conflict, too. So quiet during this period, but could be bumpy once things pass over, if they pass over. You know, we some of the things that may cause countries to be cautious here is we may get a second wave, right? In the fall,
in the winter,
sometimes with these sorts of things, you get a second wave. So I don't think anyone's going to have an itchy trigger finger, either Iran, North Korea, or anyone really, given all the uncertainty about where this virus is headed.
Oh, wouldn't that be something from your lips if, in fact, it could, in fact, flatten out, along with the curve, flatten out some of the conflicts around the world. Jim Walsh, here now, security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you. Be well.
You too.